Music you love right here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, North Korea on Tuesday fired at least one long-distance missile, which South Korea's military said was likely designed to be launched from a submarine. The launch of the missile came after South Korea successfully tested a submarine-launched ballistic missile, or SLBM, last month. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency reported that the missile flew about 430 to 450 kilometers, reaching a height of 60 kilometers. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said in a statement that North Korea launched a ballistic missile from waters near the eastern port of Sinpo. But it did not say whether the missile was fired from an underwater structure or a launch area above the surface. Sinpo is a major center for North Korea's defense industry, where the country builds submarines. In recent years, North Korea has also used Sinpo to develop ballistic weapons systems designed to be fired from submarines. There have also been signs that North Korea is trying to build a larger submarine that would be able to launch more than one missile. North Korea last tested an SLBM in October 2019. It fired a Pukuksong-3 missile from an underwater launch structure. But the North has not shown that it can fire an SLBM from a submarine. Leif Erik Easley is a professor of international studies at Ewha Women's University in Seoul. He said North Korea's SLBM is probably far from being operationally deployed with a nuclear warhead, but North Korean leader Kim cannot politically afford appearing to fall behind in a regional arms race. Other experts say that it would take years for North Korea to build submarines that could operate quietly and effectively execute strikes. Such an effort would require large amounts of resources and major technological improvements. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command stated that North Korea's latest launch did not present an immediate threat to U.S. troops, territory, or allies. Last month, North Korea claimed that it successfully tested a new hypersonic missile. The state-run Korean Central News Agency, or KCNA, released a picture of a test launch of a missile called the Hwasong-8. A hypersonic missile can fly very fast and very low, making it harder for missile defense systems to recognize and defend against. South Korea is also starting a major defense modernization plan. The plan calls for several new missiles, fighter jets, and the nation's first aircraft carrier. Later this week, South Korea is expected to launch its first space rocket developed in the country. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said tensions on the Korean Peninsula were at a critical stage. He called for renewed efforts toward a diplomatic resolution of the issue. South Korea and the United States have repeatedly offered to restart nuclear talks with North Korea, also known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK. Sung Kim is the U.S. diplomat for North Korea. He said Monday, "To reach this objective, we will seek diplomacy with the DPRK." The aim, he said, was to reduce tension and increase the security of the U.S. and its allies. "We harbor no hostile intent towards the DPRK, and we are open to meeting with them without preconditions," he added. In a speech last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un rejected those offers. Recently, the United States has frequently sent signals that it is not hostile to our state, but its behaviors provide us with no reason why we should believe them, Kim said.
It has been 1 month since the Cumbre Vieja volcano began bursting on the Spanish island of La Palma. The eruption forced Culberta Cruz, her husband, and their dog from their home. Today, they are living in a small vehicle as they wait to be able to safely return home. They see no end of their situation in sight. "I'm tired, so tired. But who are we to fight against nature?" the 56-year-old Cruz said. Cruz and her husband, banana grower Tono Gonzalez, must remove volcanic ash from their vehicle each day. The volcano continues to burst. "One day it's exploding there, the other a vent opens here," Cruz said. "It's just anguish and living in fear, waiting and praying for it to stop erupting. And it's a lot of sadness for those who lost their homes," she added. Red hot lava, or liquid rock, has covered almost 800 hectares of land. The lava has destroyed about 2,000 buildings and many banana-growing areas. The volcano started erupting on September 19th. More than 6,000 people on La Palma have had to leave their homes. The island is one of Spain's Canary Islands. The island group sits off the coast of northeastern Africa. Volcano experts have said they cannot predict for how long the Cumbre Vieja volcano will keep releasing extremely hot liquid rock. After being ordered to evacuate, Cruz and Gonzalez first stayed at a family member's farm. They later took their vehicle to a parking area. There, they could get fresh water and a bit of electricity. They are now looking into a temporary place to live that permits animals. "We don't know when it's going to stop. That's the problem," Gonzalez said. "This is nature, and we have to deal with it. It's bigger than us."
Researchers have found that about 321,000 undocumented and asylum-seeking children from Central America went to American schools from 2017 to 2019. The research was by the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit group based in California. During that same time period, the United States saw a large increase in undocumented immigrants entering the country through the southern border, mostly from Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the study says. The report estimates that 491,000 of the immigrants who remained in the United States were children, meaning just 65% enrolled in school. About 75% of the 321,000 students went to school in 10 states: California, Texas, Florida, New York, Virginia, Maryland, New Jersey, North Carolina, Georgia, and Louisiana. When inside the country, U.S. federal law guarantees children an education without considering their immigration status. U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said he supports undocumented students' right to a public education. That is a contrast from former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who testified to Congress that school districts should be able to decide whether to report undocumented students to immigration officials. Cardona said in an interview with Newsweek that when there are students that are here that need to be educated, we have an obligation. Whether or not that means they have different rights, I'll leave that to others. But when it comes to education, every student should get an education when they're here. Many states offer different levels of support to immigrants, both documented and undocumented, as well as to refugees. That can affect the quality of their education, argue the RAND researchers. Some states give students more financial aid, while some limit enrollment based on age. Some states give undocumented students access to lower in-state tuition to public universities, but others do not. Undocumented, asylum-seeking, and refugee students face great difficulties while seeking an education. They can face trauma, language barriers, culture shock, and a lack of basic needs like food and shelter. Some have never had a formal education. The RAND research focused on two districts that serve a large population of undocumented and asylum-seeking students: Jefferson Parish Schools in Louisiana and Oakland Unified School District in California. Both districts faced teacher and worker shortages, but the study noted several ways the districts were able to meet the challenges faced by that population of students. The two districts provided language supports to students and families and guaranteed in-person enrollment. The districts also hired workers to help students with social and emotional needs. Many districts were not ready for the increase in undocumented students, the researchers say. RAND estimates that 2,000 more teachers and workers were needed in the seven states with the largest number of new students to keep classes the same size. The study also points to a need for more teacher training, mental health services, and funding to districts with growing numbers of immigrants. The pandemic slowed all immigration to the United States in 2020, the study noted. But the U.S. has experienced an unprecedented number of migrants at the southern border this year, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas told reporters in August. In addition, President Joe Biden has also asked Congress for funding to resettle 95,000 Afghans by September 2022. Leslie Biegas is an education researcher with the New America Foundation. She said that fewer than half of U.S. states track students with limited formal education, who are often undocumented immigrants and refugees. Without that information, Villegas said, it can be hard to know what sort of resources districts need to support those students. Often, these are kids who have experienced trauma and face real barriers in how they interact with the education system, if they've ever interacted with the education system at all, she said. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. One day in October of 1859, Americans were shocked by news of an attack led by John Brown. He was an anti-slavery extremist. Many people also considered him a madman. John Brown had declared that he was ready to die fighting slavery. He said that God wanted him to fight slavery by invading Virginia with a military force. And even if the rebellion failed, he predicted that it would lead to a civil war between the North and the South. Should there be a war, he said, the North would break the chains of black slaves. Brown decided to strike at Harper's Ferry, a small town about 100 kilometers from Washington. It was part of Virginia at that time, but is now located in the state of West Virginia. It had a factory that made guns for the army and a supply center of valuable military equipment. Brown wanted the guns and equipment for the slave army he hoped to organize. Harper's Ferry was built on a narrow finger of land where the Shenandoah River flows into the Potomac. There was a bridge across each river. Brown organized his attack from across the Potomac in Maryland. Harry Monroe and Jack Moyles continue the story of John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry.
With his force of less than 20 men, John Brown moved through the darkness down to the bridge that crossed the Potomac River. Two men left the group to cut the telegraph lines east and west of Harper's Ferry. At the bridge, Brown's men surprised a railroad guard. They told him he was their prisoner. The guard thought they were joking until he saw their guns. Once across the bridge, Brown and his men moved quickly. They captured a few people in the street and another guard at the front gate of the government armory. They seized the armory, then crossed the street and seized the supply center. Millions of dollars worth of military equipment was kept there.
After leaving a few men to guard the prisoners, Brown and the others went to the gun factory across town. They seized the few people who were there and captured the factory. Without firing a shot, Brown now controlled the three places he wanted in Harper's Ferry. His problem now was to hold what he had captured. Brown knew he had little time. The people of the town would soon learn what had happened. They would call for help, and several groups of militia in the area would come to the aid of Harper's Ferry. Brown planned to use the people he had captured as hostages. The militia would not attack if there was danger of harming the prisoners. He wanted as many prisoners as possible to protect himself. If his plan failed, he could offer them in exchange for his own freedom and that of his men.
Brown had decided to capture as his best hostage Colonel Lewis Washington. The colonel was a descendant of President George Washington. He lived on a big farm near Harper's Ferry. Brown sent some of his men to capture the old colonel and free his slaves. They returned from the Washington farm after midnight. They brought Colonel Washington and 10 slaves. They also captured another farmer and his son. The slaves were given spears and told to guard the prisoners. Then, at the far end of the Potomac River Bridge, the first shots were fired. Brown's son, Watson, and another man fired at a railroad guard who refused to halt. A bullet struck his head, but did not hurt him seriously. The guard raced back across the bridge to the railroad station. He cried out that a group of armed men had seized the bridge.
A few minutes later, a train from the west arrived at Harper's Ferry. The wounded guard warned the trainmen of the danger at the bridge. Two of the trainmen decided to investigate. They walked toward the bridge. Before they could reach it, bullets began whizzing past them. They ran back to the train and moved it farther from the bridge. Then a free Negro man who worked at the railroad station, Hayward Shepherd, walked down to the bridge. Brown's men ordered him to halt. Shepherd tried to run and was shot. He got back to the station, but died several hours later.
Brown finally agreed to let the train pass over the bridge and continue on to Baltimore. The train left at sunrise. By this time, word of Brown's attack had spread to Charlestown, more than 12 kilometers away. Officials called out the militia, ordering the men of Charlestown to get ready to go to the aid of Harper's Ferry. Soon after sunrise, men began arriving at Harper's Ferry from other towns in the area. They took positions above the armory and started shooting at it. The militia from Charlestown arrived at the Maryland end of the Potomac Bridge. They charged across, forcing Brown's men on the bridge to flee to the armory. Only one of Brown's men was hit. He was killed instantly.
Brown saw that he was surrounded. His only hope was to try to negotiate a ceasefire and offer to release his 30 hostages if the militia would let him and his men go free. Brown sent out one of his men and one of the prisoners with a white flag. The excited crowd refused to recognize the white flag. They seized Brown's man and carried him away. Brown moved his men and the most important of his hostages into a small brick building at the armory. Then he sent out two more of his men with a prisoner to try to negotiate a ceasefire. One of them was his son, Watson.
This time, the crowd opened fire. Watson and the other raider were wounded. Their prisoner escaped to safety. Watson was able to crawl back to the armory. One of the youngest of Brown's men, William Lehman, tried to escape. He ran from the armory and jumped into the Potomac, planning to swim across the river. He did not get far. A group of militia saw him and began shooting. Lehman was forced to hide behind a rock in the middle of the river. Two men went out to the rock with guns and shot him. His body lay in the river for 2 days. Later, more people were killed. One was the mayor of Harper's Ferry, Fontaine Beckham.
After the mayor's death, a mob went to the hotel where one of Brown's men had been held since he was seized earlier in the day. They pulled him from the hotel and took him to the bridge over the river. Several members of the mob put guns to his head and fired. They pushed his body off the bridge and into the water. Across town, three of Brown's men were in trouble at the gun factory. The factory was built on an island in the Shenandoah River. The island was now surrounded by militia. 40 of the soldiers attacked the factory from three sides. They pushed the three raiders back to a small building next to the river. The three men fought as long as possible. Then they jumped through a window into the river. They tried to swim to safety. Men with guns were waiting for them. Bullets fell around the three like rain. One man was hit. He died instantly. Another was wounded. He was pulled to land and left to die. The third man escaped death. He was captured and held for trial.
All through the afternoon and evening, Brown's men at the armory continued to exchange shots with the militia. Several more on both sides were killed or wounded. One of those was another of Brown's sons, Oliver. He was shot and seriously wounded. Night fell. Then a militia officer, Captain Sin, walked up to the small building held by Brown. He shouted to the men inside that he wished to talk. Brown opened the door and let him in. For almost an hour, the two men talked. They talked about slavery and the right to rebel against the government.
Brown was furious that the crowd outside had refused to honor his white flag of truce earlier in the day. He told Sin that his men could have killed unarmed men and women, but did not do so. "That is not quite correct," Captain Sin said. "Mayor Beckham had no gun when he was shot." "Then I can only say I am most sad to hear it," said Brown. "Men who take up guns against the government," said Sin, "must expect to be shot down like dogs."
In Washington, President Buchanan and Secretary of War John Floyd did not learn of the rebellion at Harper's Ferry until after 10 o'clock that morning. The president wanted immediate action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.